Good morning, everyone. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us for this track. I have Jason Heckel here from Milestone Strategy Group. You may recognize the name and his infamous Twitter handle, The Heckler, from his time at Serious Decisions, but he's here to join us today to talk about entitlements to experiments, and also feel free to ask him about some of his recent travels, which I think he's going to go into a little bit here. So thanks, Jason.
Thank you, Erica. So thank you. We're going to have some fun in this session, let me tell you. I'm pretty excited to be here because the last time I spoke at this event, I actually had walking pneumonia and I was on stage with a 103 degree fever, thought I was going to fall off, and I feel 10 times better today. So, I'm a consultant, an independent consultant now that does demand strategy. I do ABM blueprints, I do workshops, I do coaching. But I came to this role most recently running the demand practice at Serious Decisions. Before that, I ran marketing for two different software companies in the Bay Area. So what I'm going to share with you today is actually kind of the collective experiences and observations I've had across all those roles. And I really want to talk about why I am really excited, and really it's been reinforced by the event this week, on what a great opportunity this is for us as a renaissance for B2B marketers. I'm going to talk about that in the context of how we can challenge some of the entitlements and assumptions that we have long operated against. I'm going to share a lot of stories on how I've seen those in my experiences. So I'm going to start by saying when I left Serious Decisions last year, I took some time off, and then I planned this fantastic trip for my family to Europe, where we spent 9.5 weeks going everywhere from London to Iceland. We went up to Norway. We spent time in Scotland. We went to Munich. We went to Prague. And then we spent five weeks in Italy. We spent time in Florence. We spent time in Siena. And you know, I'm really taking inspiration from my talk here today in terms of, you know, all the things that we got to see. It also gave me a really good excuse to put some images of from the 10,000 photos I took and get to see them on the big screen, right? But the whole idea was, you know, when you think about the Renaissance, it's the period of time that kind of bridges the medieval period with kind of modern history. And it's really characterized by advances in everything from architecture to art to music, to literature, to even politics. And, you know, one of the things, you know, that I wanted to highlight here is it's really stories of achievement, human achievement, right? And I take for inspiration this notion of a Renaissance man. And I think that there's actually a parallel with what we're seeing in B2B marketing. You know, learning never exhausts the mind. I think as B2B marketers today, you have to be in constant learning mode. You have seen presentations all week of really great examples of practitioners that have been putting the pieces together and learning along the way. You've heard about their successes, and I've seen quite a few presentations where they've actually shared some of the failures and what they've learned from it. And I want to kind of explore some of that today as well. And I'm going to start, oops, a little too fast. All right. I want to start with a little bit of some stories here. You know, when I think about this renaissance in B2B marketing, technology plays a big part in it. Technology is an enabler. The real renaissance is what we do as marketers. It's the processes, it's the changes that we adapt. And I like to look at this graphic that I'm sure everybody here has seen from Scott Brinker. When you look at this marketing technology landscape that has gone from 150 different solutions in 2011, and today, or in the 2016, it was over 3,800 different solutions across 3,500 different companies. He's due for an update in 2017. But the really amazing thing about this is that's a tremendous amount of change in a really short period of time. There is nobody that can keep on top of this entire chart. Every event I go to, you know, I see new technologies I've never heard of. Every client I talk to has something new in their marketing stack that I have not even heard of. There's nobody that can put it. As an analyst, I took briefings all the time, and you still cannot keep on top of it. So it creates some anxiety, but it also creates a fantastic opportunity. And it's an enabler. And I think about my career has spanned over 20 years in B2B sales and marketing. When I think back early in my career, I sold enterprise software to insurance companies. And I think about what I had at my disposal from a marketing standpoint, selling software, B2B, back then when client server was cutting edge, to an audience that primarily had mainframes. 20 years ago, I had, anybody sell into insurance? Do you know what AM Best catalogs are? These humongous binders that had every little detail of information about insurance companies. I had that. I had a goldmine CD that my company gave me. And I had a box full of folders with some slicks in it. And that was my marketing support. And I was a salesperson. 10 years ago, when I got into demand marketing, it's actually closer to 12 years ago, but when I first got into demand marketing in Silicon Valley, I was one of the first buyers of Eloqua, right? And back then, I think it was really Eloqua. Demand Base was pretty new back then. There was Salesforce. There wasn't really much else. It was really, really early. And I thought that was cutting edge. And the really crazy thing about it is some of those things that I was doing 10 years ago that were quite innovative at the time in Eloqua are inconsequential today. That's how fast change is occurring. So, and even as we look at this now, you see all the hype cycles that we have gone through. Everything from marketing automation, revenue performance management. We've seen inbound marketing. We've seen predictive. We've seen intent. All these things are going on, and there's fantasticness. You know, fantastic innovations coming on. AI is very hot in marketing right now. And I will go on record in saying, I think the big challenge that we have as marketers is not the technology. I think, for the most part, technology works as it's intended to work. The products oftentimes do exactly what they're stated to do, which is very different from early in my career where I was really worried that our software actually wouldn't work. You know, you would always worry about it actually being able to plug in and actually do what it says it does. That's not our problem anymore. Our problem is really trying to navigate all the complexity that we have here and tie these things together. And I think when I think about this as a renaissance, it's really not about the technology. The technology is the enabler, but the achievement is human. It's because we are marketers. It's a human endeavor. So I think when we think about this as a renaissance man, somebody who is always learning and how we apply that, technology allows us to do things that we haven't done before. And I want to talk about some of these marketing initiatives and these changes in using technology in the context of kind of putting up for argument some of the assumptions and entitlements that we've operated under. But I want you to think about this as when you are basically undertaking some of these initiatives, for every question that you answer, there's probably two more questions you want to ask. And I've seen a lot of examples of that, and I want to kind of reinforce that as we go through the presentation. So the very first assumption that I want to go through, or the thought that I want to challenge, I want to explore, is we measure one funnel. When I landed in Silicon Valley, you know, the very first CEO that I worked for, when he said to me, he said, Jason, marketing is demand here. I need you to fill the pipeline. I need you to fill that funnel. And I had to go in and report out to the board of directors on a monthly basis. And I had a funnel model. Now, I'm taking a little bit of a humorous stance on it because I love the Marketoonist, right? But it was very much about a funnel, and it was singular, and it was directional, and it was about what was I doing as a head of marketing, and what was I handing over to a sales team, and what were they closing. And the really ironic thing about this is I spent so much time at Serious Decisions talking about the demand waterfall. You know, that fell under the practice I ran. And you know, if you think about what the waterfall, when it was first developed, what that was intended to do, it was a process model meant to align sales and marketing activities towards the closure of new business. But in working with clients, a lot of times, I saw the funnel or the waterfall be completely abused because it became primarily the measurement model that would show that marketing would use to prove their value, and quite frankly, would lead to a lot of arguments with the sales team because they would dispute it, even though the model itself was really designed for alignment. So this notion of having a singular funnel to measure against, it's limiting, and I'm challenging you to rethink that. And it was really interesting because Dana talked in that last call, you know, there's that whole category of software that allows you to do a lot more with funnel analysis. And that's really kind of what I want to dive into here. Because if you think about it as, you know, multiple funnels, each of which has different flavors, it goes from being a single funnel that you measure to multiple funnels that you use to diagnose performance. And that's a mind shift, right? That goes from a situation where, okay, you might have a roll-up of that funnel that's helpful for directional performance. But if you're really trying to get into, you know, and this was a situation I ran into in board meetings. They would challenge me, how come we're not growing this fast? Or how come we're having, you know, things here or there? And the data, when you have a singular funnel view, doesn't allow you to say, for example, how are we performing in a specific vertical? Because the numbers are actually buried in the aggregate, right? So you have to pull out these different views. You know, one of my colleagues at Serious Decisions called it waterfall personalities. But it's the idea of saying, you know, if you look at if your waterfall, right, and you say, okay, we're underperforming, we want to be better than what we're doing. The very first question I would ask a client is, well, if you look at inquiries at the top of the funnel How many of those inquiries meet your target market? And if you can't even answer that question, everything else beneath it is going to be meaningless, right? Because what they're doing is they're counting records as opposed to counting performance against a audience offering pairing, right? So I think there's really great opportunity for us to say, oh, well, how do we actually think about this so that it becomes a diagnostic for our business? And I think the technologies that have developed are great enablers for this. Back when I did it, 12 plus years ago, I had a spreadsheet. It was really hard, to pull this information. Salesforce wasn't architected to do the type of analysis that I wanted to do. And today, you've got BrightFunnel, you've got Hive9, you've got companies like FunnelWise, a new one, FunnelCake, that's only a few months old, that are all going in and saying, let's rationalize that funnel. Because if you think about the funnel, it's pretty misleading because the denominator changes as you go down. Like when you talk at the top, when you talk about inquiries, are actually responses. And then you have individual contact records, and you can actually get down to opportunities, which are account measures. There's a lot of reconciliation that needs to go on. But these tools out there that allow you to correct for that and allow you to measure volume, conversion, velocity, and then apply filters to it so that you're actually analyzing it for different contexts, it's a really powerful tool to say, okay, well, let me dive into this a little further. I've seen companies that have gone out and said, okay, well, let me go out and have a different funnel for each industry that we go into. And they will see completely different performance dynamics through, completely different marketing mix. And they might see that for insurance, they might actually be struggling with filling the top of the funnel, but whereas they might see in banking, they're actually having things stall out later on. And when you actually take away this construct that you're thinking about it in terms of a funnel as a singular, and say it's not just about measurement, but I really want to use the funnel for a diagnostic so that I can improve program performance in a very agile way, tools like BrightFunnel, FunnelWise, and all the others are incredibly helpful for you to do that. So that's one. So I would encourage you, if you are looking at this today and you refer to your demand process as a singular funnel, throw that out and say, okay, well, really, who are we marketing to with what offerings? What are the different ways I can slice and dice that funnel? Can I do it by campaign source? Can I do it by time cohorts? Is there seasonality built into it? I've seen companies go so far as to actually measure their funnel by trigger events, where they will have kind of before and after and use that trigger event as one of the variables that they want to control for. So a fantastic opportunity for marketers out there. Now the second one I want to go into is a little bit of a tough one for me, because it gets into lead scoring. And this is both a truth and a falsehood. So scored leads convert better. Yes and no, right? And I will tell you, it's hard for me to say. As one of Eloqua's early adopters, my team at Inquirer actually won the very first Markey Award for lead scoring, right? And when you think about the first rev of lead scoring through the marketing automation platforms, it is based on assumptions. It is based on what you can actually see inside of your systems that are connected to it, right? And some were better at making those assumptions than other. But oftentimes, anybody who's bought software, and the really interesting thing is probably everybody in here probably has bought software, you probably recognize that there's a lot more that goes into a buying decision than meets the eye. And that's why I kind of pulled this up. And the story I like to tell is when I first bought Eloqua, Jill Rowley was actually my sales rep, the Eloqueen, right? And she did a really good job of managing relationships. She nurtured all this. But when it really came down to why was I able to buy Eloqua at that point in time, it had nothing to do with anything she could see in any of her systems. Because what happened was my CEO, one day, had a VC in his office that was considering an investment in Eloqua at the time. My CEO got talking to that VC. He says, I think my head of marketing was actually looking at Eloqua. He pulled me into his office, and the VC went on to say what a huge opportunity this was and how excited they were, but they had to pass because the valuation was too rich. That was actually the trigger event, that third-party validation from a VC who was anywhere near Eloqua's marketing at the time. That had a huge impact. So when you're talking about lead scoring was based on what you could see. It was a lot of times based on assumption, some collective knowledge, maybe some pattern analysis, but it was very limiting, right? It could only be based on what you see. But now you add in all the technology that we have available, all the intelligence. You look at scoring today has taken on so many more flavors. I saw multiple presentations this week of companies, which quite honestly, for the first time, I've seen really starting to connect the dots, where you now have not only your traditional lead scoring like I did back then, but they're enriching that First of all, they're enriching the data that they have through all the fantastic contact sources they have, but then they're applying intent data on top of it. They're looking at technographics data. They're applying predictive models against it. And now what you're doing is not basing your lead scoring just on what you can see, but what you cannot see, some lookalike models. Does it mean that every highest scored lead will actually convert? No, it does not. But it does mean that you will actually have a much higher confidence interval that you have selected the right target to go after. And when you're thinking about the efficiency through the funnel in terms of sales and marketing activities, the impact on prioritization is real. So while I would say scored leads, if you looked at the early adopters on marketing automation, I worked with a lot of clients at Serious Decisions where they could not prove that their scoring model worked because it was entirely based on assumptions. Today, that's not necessarily true because we have so much more technology. It is such a better enabler for all of us as marketers. So the third one is probably my favorite, to be honest. As a head of marketing, I often lobbied for and had SDR teams that reported into me because I was a firm believer that it's really hard for a head of marketing to prove impact if you do not at least control the activity flow up to the point of opportunity creation, right? So, but every company, a lot of the companies I've worked at, sales is entitled to SDR support. It's just been an assumption. And I wonder why. And I think now we're actually in a great opportunity to kind of challenge that assumption. It's like a buffet, right? That's what I put up here. Every company that I worked for as a VP marketing, you know, we had to try to provide SDR support equally across everybody on the sales team. But there was no cost to the sales team. And anytime you have a buffet, no matter how good it looks, if it's free, people are not going to value it as much as they should. And you're going to end up with a lot of lead waste. And ironically, when I actually researched the imagery for this presentation, I found that the amount of food waste in U.S. is something that between 30 and 40% of our food is wasted, ends up in landfill. 49,000 pounds of food a day from restaurants, from buffets like I showed. And it's basically simple economics. It's supply and demand. So bringing that back to the SDRs, the question becomes, why is it an entitlement, right? And I think a lot of innovation comes up. There's a lot of experimentation you can do to disrupt that. And I know sometimes it's not practical to change things wholesale, but you start with small tests. So I was going to give you a few examples. There was one company that I worked with that did something that was quite fantastic. They had a huge sales organization, like 2,000 different sales agents across North America with limited marketing support. And the head of marketing there, they put together he didn't call it a tiger team, but in essence, it was like a tiger team. It was like almost like a demand pod. And what he had he had SDR support, two SDRs on each one of these teams. He had a campaigns manager. He had a marketing ops person that went into the data. And what they basically did is he put together an application process. He said, okay, I have this basically self-contained unit that can run 2 to 3 month programs on behalf of sales reps individually. And what he did, he says, well, I'm going to actually deliver this as a service for the reps who are willing to put skin in the game. There was a cost. There was an application process. And the really amazing thing about that is he went out and he found some friendly salespeople who really appreciated the value of marketing and got them to sign up. And they went through what was an account-based exercise to figure out what a really tight, cohesive program would be. And it worked. The guy doubled his pipeline inside of the 3 months, and it was fantastic. And what did that do? That actually created pull within the organization so that more and more salespeople actually wanted to apply for that type of program. So that allowed him to expand this program. He actually franchised the model across different sales offices. Not so that it was an entitlement for everybody in sales. He always wanted the demand to exceed the supply so that there was skin on the game on the part of the sales team. And what did that mean? That means that he actually had a tight collaboration coordination between sales and marketing on developing those programs. And it meant that the performance was great. There was so little lead waste associated with it. Another example that I've seen a lot of fantastic work with clients to do is as companies have gotten bigger, they've started to specialize the SDR role. And I think there's a lot more opportunity for investment there. I worked with a client when I was at Serious Decisions that their highest performing channel was chat through their websites, where they made actually fantastic investments, and this was in their European division, where they went so far is to actually invest in technology that would allow a centralized English-speaking call center unit that was filled with SDRs would take chats through that center, but they had technology that would be able to take the chat in any language, convert it to English, they would write their response in English, and it would convert it back to the native language. And they had 2x the conversion rate on interactions through that channel than anywhere else. It was a specialized unit. They didn't basically take SDRs who were making outbound calls or answering inbound calls and just put them on chat. They trained specially for that and had a huge lift on conversion. So again, fantastic opportunity to say, well, let's really think about that SDR role. Let's think about the channels through which we communicate with our prospective buyers and what's the right way to do it. And there's a lot of experimentation. I did a program. Oh, I'll say another one that was really interesting is, and it kind of ties back to one of the first examples. When I talked about doing the funnel diagnostics, I worked with a company where they actually defined a funnel for each sales rep, which was really interesting, right? So each territory and each individual sales rep, and they could compare their performance against each other, but they could also see within that what level of marketing effort was aligned to each one of those individual reps. And then they basically were able to calculate using one of these tools that I didn't have available 10 years ago to say, okay, well, now we can calculate across that entire sales team what are our velocity and the conversion rates, and what would the impact actually be on both pipeline and revenue if we were to raise up everyone to the mean, right? Because you had underperformers, you had overperformers. Well, they ran a test using an SDR team. It's like, well, let's actually look at the 2 or 3 high performers, and let's see if we can test how high their ceiling will go. Right? So they said rather than actually allocate what essentially was a dedicated tiger team of SDRs, so they had kind of everybody had SDR support, but they said we're going to carve out some SDRs to do these special programs with those. But rather than apply it to the underperformers, they did a test where they did it to the overperformers to see how much higher they could go in terms of the pipeline they would create. And that was phenomenal. They found they were able to actually increase pipeline on one of the reps by as much as 30%, and I think the lowest one was like 12%. But it was incredible. And you know, typically, your overperforming sales reps are ones that will never say they don't have enough capacity. And it was a great way to say, how can we efficiently utilize this SDR resource? And in that case, the SDRs weren't actually doing a lot of outbound calling. They weren't trying to pound the phones. They were doing a lot of account development work. They were actually going out and researching the accounts and populating custom fields inside the CRM with specific account level and contact level intelligence that then fed into a drip campaign that went out to each one of those accounts. It was kind of an early version of account-based marketing. So really compelling stories on what you can do if you think about it that way. The fourth one kind of ties in. This is the last one I'm gonna touch on, but I think it relates to the others. And there's always been a mindset, certainly been at the companies I've worked at, and I'd say the majority of clients I worked with at Serious Decisions, where there's kind of a divide between sales and marketing. Don't touch my active accounts. There's a real fear on the part of sales that marketing will disrupt their sales cycles if they market to anybody who has an active opportunity. And there's good reason for that. You know, when you're doing broad-based marketing communications and you're not really being tight with how you're targeting it, you run a lot of risk of disrupting it. And it works out into an environment where you see, you know, something like this, where it's split up between the top of the funnel and the bottom, what's mine, what's yours. But I do think there is a huge opportunity to really apply some of these other things that we talked about. The funnel diagnostics allow you to look at this on a rep-by-rep basis. You can look at your scoring models, and scoring models are fantastic. I didn't say it before, but when you're applying all these other, you know, indicators into it, whether it be predictive or intent, you're not just scoring for the individual, you're scoring for the account, but you're also scoring for propensity to buy specific products. You have so much more intelligence to target and prioritize your efforts. So when you think about this, I had worked for a CEO one time whose point of view was that, you know, marketing is really strategic sales. And, you know, I think that's good. I mean, yesterday we saw, Sydney Sloan got up on stage, and I think the thing that impressed me the most in her talk was she got up there and she said, you know, I really don't care how much marketing contributes to pipeline. I'm really worried about what comes out the other end. And I think that's a big takeaway. When you think about these assumptions and these entitlements that you have, a lot of us organize our marketing teams by the functions they perform, and we're very focused on the activities. I have event marketers, and we're looking at, you know, how many people will show up. Or I've got social media, I'm looking at how things are shared, or I'm developing content, and I'm looking for engagement. That's good. You want to be able to compare tactics like that against like tactics to see if you get the most engagement, the most participation, things like that. But that doesn't necessarily speak to the outcome you're trying to achieve or the impact, because that usually requires, you know, pollination across the different marketing functions, right? So when I look at something like this, I see an absolutely great opportunity to, you know, pull these things together. And when I did a lot of alignment workshops at Serious Decisions, where I would get sales and marketing in the room and try to define a service level agreement that would map to their waterfall. And to a T, every time I got into that situation, sales was very enthused, and we would require that the sales leader would be in the room. And when you ask that sales leader, he would always say, well, I just want more leads, and I want them to be higher quality. And you know, it's hard to do that, right? How do I get more and higher quality at the same time? And they kind of don't go hand in hand. Typically, you're going to give up quantity to get quality. But the sales leader wants more quality, but he doesn't want to give up the leads. But he won't necessarily say, so he'll say to you, he'll say, well, my team will call on them. My team will call on every lead. They'll call on every lead. And they won't. They won't call on every lead. And you don't want them to call on every lead. But what he's really telling you is they're a fear of missing out. They don't want to miss anything, right? So they, you know, it's a visibility problem. So you can solve that problem by just letting them have visibility into the systems and say it, but they don't necessarily require. They're only required to call on certain really highly qualified leads and opportunities. And when you think about this on how you can actually tie back together, I'll give you an example of a campaign that we did, or a program where we ran, where we said, let's kind of do away with this. Don't touch my active accounts. If you're afraid that we're going to mess it up, let's address that head on. How can we do that? And this is where you start to see sales enablement programs come up. Marketing can develop small net phishing plays where it is a coordinated marketing outreach, advertising on an account level, and triggered, and this is the important part, triggered by the sales rep, right? So in a way, you become that enablement platform. You know, I did one where it was based on, you know, an account model with each sales rep where they looked at it. Has anybody heard of Connect and Sell? Anybody ever use that tool? Still around in the back? One of the most fascinating technologies I've ever put in. So Connect and Sell is a really interesting model where it basically amplifies the number of connects that you'll get. So we basically, that you call in, it gives you, it's an auto-dialing thing, but it's offshore. So your SDR will dial into a number in the system, and other people will dial on their behalf, and basically they patch in, and it's instantaneous. It's amazing. It does exactly what it says it's going to do. But if you think about the average SDR might be able to get 5 or 6 people a day on the phone. They leave a lot of voicemails. They send a lot of email. But you know, my argument was to my CEO and to the board is like the people who actually spend the most time talking to prospective buyers are actually your SDRs, right? If you can get them on the phone. So if I can get more of them on the phone, all the better. So we designed this program and said, let's pull, you know, sales and marketing and the SDR team together to go after an account-based model. And we used Connect and Sell for that outreach part because instead of it taking, you know, 8 connects in a day, they might get 8 connects in an hour. So over a 2-hour calling session or 3-hour calling session, they could reach, you know, 2 or 3 dozen different people. Fantastic, right? But some people were scared to death of it. You know, I thought this would be a thing that every single sales rep would want to use it as part of an integrated program. And half of them were scared to death. So I had half that would use it, and it would double their pipeline overnight, and the other half would do everything they possibly could to avoid using it. They wouldn't actually take the time they saved in outreach to actually prepare for those calls, and it was a mismatch. But I bring that up as an illustration of something that both works and did not work. And what was the differentiating factor was not the technology, but it was the process and the strategy. It was about matching your marketing capabilities, the tools that you have, with both the capabilities and the demand from the sales organization. But I think there's a great opportunity to do things like this. Everybody's been talking about account-based marketing, but when you think about the tools that we have around marketing automation and all the different channels through which we communicate, there is so much opportunity for sales enablement and acceleration deeper in that funnel. And as long as it's triggered by some type of sales buy-in to that process, it really does become that joint funnel. And if you disrupt that notion that we started with, that there's a single funnel view, that you know marketing's only responsible for the top half, and you're just thinking about a number of leads or MQLs or how many opportunities you create or what percent of it, and you're really focused on that impact at the bottom, it kind of takes away the marker between them and fosters that collaboration. So I'm a huge fan of trying to knock this one down and say, you know, particularly with marketing having so much budget to invest in this technology and the data, think about how can you actually activate that to be a real enabler for the sales team. So those were the four. Hopefully I gave you kind of a point of view and said, listen, don't think about your funnel as a singular measure of your performance, but look at it as multiple lenses by which you can diagnose your marketing and sales activities. That's one. You know, look at, you know, the SDR team and says, does it really make sense as an entitlement to all, one size fits all, or are there opportunities to experiment, even if you're just carving out a portion of that team for dedicated programs and find a way so that sales has a stake in it. They can opt into it, or they have to apply for it, or you use it to experiment with high performers. You know, look at, you know, lead scoring and say, wow, okay, do scored leads convert better? Yes and no, right? You gotta take a real critical eye to it. If you're scoring leads today, make sure you establish a baseline to see if you see scored leads actually have a lift and improvement. And if you're not already investing in some of these supplemental technologies to make scoring better by looking outside of your data, do an experiment. Don't just turn it on and expect magic to happen, because a lot of these are gonna take some work, but do that. And lastly, you know, basically don't buy into this notion that there is a huge sales and marketing divide and that you cannot work on active accounts. It should be a driver to say, no, we are actually incentivized by exactly the same thing, close one business. How can I basically combine my marketing efforts with your sales efforts so that collectively we all win and close more business? So thank you. My name again, Jason Heckel. I am an aspiring Renaissance marketer. I like to work with companies that are willing to disrupt the status quo and really challenge some of these assumptions and drive process and change inside their organizations, utilizing technology to do it well. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason.